Hello, I'm Fern Cotton, and this is Happy Place, a little safe space that we've made for people to come and share how they cope out there in the real world. Oh, today, my guest is the wonderful Philip Schofield.
You know, the loop is, you have to come out. This is the only thing that can save you. You have to come out. You can't come out. You can't come out. What are you going to do to the family? What will you do to your wife? How can you possibly come out? You have to come out. You can't come out. You have to. You can't. All night, round and round and round and round, looking at every conceivable part of this loop.
Now, I know Philip needs no introduction whatsoever, but for the sake of our ever-growing international listeners, Philip has been on British TV since the early 80s, moving from children's TV to prime time, as well as hosting This Morning for nearly two whole decades. And it was on that very show, back in March, that Philip announced to millions that with the strength and support of my wife, Stephanie, and my daughters, I've been coming to terms with the fact that I am gay. There's been a huge outpouring of love for him since then, but this is the first podcast interview that he's given. I feel really honoured about that, and I can't wait to share it with you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, should we do this? Here's the show. Philip, it's so lovely to see you face to face. I'm so glad that this isn't on Zoom and that we
too.
Are socially distanced.
I'm
today.
So over all of that.
So over all of that. I worked out we've known each other about 20 years now.
Is that how long it is? Good heavens.
I know. Isn't
What's
it
our finest? Our finest moment, I think, would be at Buckingham Palace.
Oh, it's so weird because the majority of times I've seen you has been in the presence of royalty. Every time I see you, we're in some sort of royal lineup or doing a Prince's Trust thing.
We ended up in front having met the Queen in a private meeting.
Oh, I know.
Away from everybody else, and neither of us could quite understand how that had happened. And then the doors opened and the Queen is behind us and we're desperately trying to get out of her way.
Yeah. It was, the whole thing was beyond
awkward. She's behind us again.
Didn't she say she was a huge fan of Dancing on Ice or something on that occasion? She was a big fan of one of your shows, she was saying to you.
I think she was across This Morning. She was across This Morning.
I love that the Queen's watching This Morning.
I mean, I don't know whether that's true.
She
was just well briefed, I'm sure. Although, Denise, the lovely, lovely late Denise Robertson, met her and something along the lines of, Denise started to explain what she did, and the Queen said, "I know." So she knew Denise.
She knows. Yeah. She knows it all.
Yeah.
I sent you a rambling voice note at the weekend,
which was really very, very sweet.
Well, God, I knew your book was going to be wonderful, but I first of all couldn't put it down because of several reasons. It's unbelievably honest and brave, and also just all of the great geeky TV stuff. So it was just for me like the perfect book, and I loved reading it. It's obviously such an intimate endeavor writing a book. I've been through the process myself several times, and then you've got a release.
Yes.
Bloody thing. So how are you feeling at this stage ahead of publication?
Honestly, I'm actually quite scared because I haven't done it before, and I didn't actually think that I was ever going to do it anyway. And it was only the circumstances that we all found ourselves in. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? What are you going to do? I mean, I wrote the first chapter in 2017. And that was because of pressure from my office, our office, who said, so many people saying they want you to write, you want you to write your story. And I'd always said, no, I don't really think so. Because in the latter years, I knew where I'd have to take it. And then in 2017, in the summer, in Portugal, with Steph, and I wrote the first chapter and sent it to them. I don't know why I did it, but I wrote the first chapter and sent it to them, and they all went, oh my God, you have to write, you have to finish this. You have to finish this. And I went back under a stone and I didn't think about it at all. And then everything happens, you know, life happens. And as anyone who reads the book will know, the event happens, because that's what we all called it, still call it. And I ended up locked down and doing This Morning, thank goodness, doing This Morning in the mornings, which saved my sanity. Because bear in mind, I came out on the 7th of February, and then 3-4 weeks later, we're locked down. Mm. And as I've joked in there, you know, I come out and the world goes in. And so, you know, what are the chances of that?
I know.
What are the chances?
I mean, what a year for you personally. Globally, we're all going through it, and you're going through your own situations as well. And you've had this, I imagine, catharsis in writing this book.
Yeah.
And
well, there was a catharsis, certainly. It was fun to write it down, and it was fun to, until the last two or three chapters, which was not a lot of fun. But how do I feel now, having done it? It's, you know, it was weird to get it as a thing, as a touchable thing, because it's always just been notes on my laptop, you know, written on my laptop. And then suddenly it exists, and you think, when it came the other day by courier, the first ever copy that I'd seen, and I looked at it and thought, oh my God, it's real. Mm. You've done this. Mm. You've really done this. And what's more, you're going to have to talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, this is the next stage of it. And it's, you know, I've felt like that even doing the audio version of a book. You write it and then having to say it aloud, it is a beautiful, painful, full circle process of writing it. And then I always get the worst sore throat after doing an audio book, because it's almost like you are exorcising everything. It's coming out of you, and you're speaking your truth, and it's very real going through that process.
Well, the audio book was something that I was dreading.
Yeah.
Actually quite scared of it. And Michael Joseph, who are the publishers, who are just the sweetest, kindest, nicest people, said, don't worry, we'll make sure you're okay. And I arrived at the audiobook studios in Tottenham Court, just off Tottenham Court Road, and there was a lovely engineer stroke producer called Joss. And Joss sat me down and said, I've read the last three chapters, and he said, I figure that's where we're going to have our issues. So I said, yeah, possibly. And so he said, listen, we're both in this together. He said, I'll look after you. There's no point. There were times when I was sobbing in the booth, and he said, right, okay, let's stop now. I'll make you a cup of tea. And so it was tough to say out loud. And there were bits that surprised me when I read them out loud. Not actually the things that you would expect, but the big moments in my life. You know, the radio, when you've been a kid, and you have run down to the end of Fistral Beach in your bare feet to watch the Radio 1 Roadshow set up, because I was always the first one there to watch it set up every year. And then I got into hospital radio, and I had a reason to interview the DJs. I interviewed Paul Burnett, and so that was it was the circus coming to town. And then years later, Radio 1 say, do you want to do the roadshow from Newquay? And it was like, and when I read that out loud, it made me cry.
I bet.
Because it was such a big moment for me.
Yeah, of course. And I was so fascinated because, you know, like me, from a very young age, you had this bizarre obsession with radio and TV. And at that point, I guess, when you're a kid, you don't even know why. You just had, there's a pull towards the magic of it. And you want in, but you don't know if that's ever going to happen. But it becomes an acute focus. There's one thing really wanting to do something, and it's another to be naturally good at it. Did you have an inkling that your skill set, just who you are as a person, would lend itself to doing that?
Not a clue.
So it was just bloody good luck that you could do it.
Oh, I mean, how much of what we do is luck?
Oh, I mean, completely. But I think you seemed, from reading the book, so comfortable in front of a camera from day one. You know, no nerves and just at peace in front of a camera. And I think that's very special.
It's never intimidated me. I've never felt intimidated. I mean, when things go wrong, suddenly you're on a heightened state of alert. But I don't think I've ever felt intimidated by a camera. Probably because I practiced so much. I sat so much. And I talked to myself for hours, you know, presenting things to cardboard boxes.
Yeah, I used to make radio shows on cassette with my cousins, and boss, they would be like the weather person, a small part, and I would be the anchor of the show. But then, in comparison, when you were in theatre, you've revealed that you had huge imposter syndrome being in that space.
Oh, massively. Because TV and radio, I had this sort of strange relationship with, and I still don't know which one I love the most. But the theatre was not a plan. Radio and TV were definitely, they were the only plan. If I didn't do one of those, don't know what I would have ended up doing. But the theatre was a shock that came out of nowhere. And it's not just any old theatre. So the first time, I went from being a mouse to Prince Charming in our school panto. But other than that, by the way, Andrew Lloyd Webber's asked if you'd like to be Joseph on stage at the London Palladium, you know, one of the most famous theatres in the world. Mm. 2,500 people. Are you joking? And it took, you know, I said, I don't know whether I can do this. And it was the people around me, and principally Steph, actually, who said, well, don't you decide whether you think you can do it. Let them tell you whether they think you can do it. And then they did and said, yeah, absolutely, we think you can.
But even after all of those shows, you still now have this sort of background fear of singing out loud.
Absolutely.
Yeah, how funny.
I really struggle. I get no enjoyment out of it whatsoever.
Wow.
Because I tell the last time I sang out loud was on Saturday Night Takeaway for the boys, and only the boys would get me to
absolutely.
Do it.
Absolutely.
There's no other people
would
get
persuasive.
Me to do it.
Very persuasive.
On the telly, live on the telly, as the big finale of their set to come out and sing, I was galvanised with utter terror. And I thought, you know, you get no enjoyment out of this. Mm. Why are you doing this?
Yeah.
And I wish I did.
Mm. Well, you're good at it, so it is a shame. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It's funny, because I feel like that about parts of my career, which I've fallen, not out of love with, but just there's too much fear surrounding some parts of it, and I don't think it's worth it. I don't think it's worth feeling stressed.
Which bits for you?
I guess if I'm really honest, it's stuff that hasn't come from me. Because when I'm working for other people, I never feel like I'm doing good enough. I'm always living up to someone else's expectations. Whereas with my own projects, I think I know what I'm capable of and I know what I could do here. So I feel really liberated. Mm. So I've gone a bit too far down that road, perhaps. But, you know, we'll see. It's all a big learning curve. I want to start right at the beginning of the book, because there were so many fascinating bits in the prologue, and there was a couple of lines that really stuck out. One was that you really seem keen, well, you express it, to show people the real you. And it's a question I think many of us ask ourselves. I certainly do. You know, who am I? Who am I? Sometimes I have clarity over it. Other times I'm lost in the roles and the responsibilities, and I sort of forget. And I wonder if, sat here today, you know who you are. You feel like you really know what you're about and who you are as a person.
That's a really interesting question, because I have a feeling that if I sit here now, I probably know less of who I am than I did before. This is my life and my head. There's no question. I mean, I have pressed the nuke button, as I say, and I am still learning what that means. I'm still learning what effects that has on my life and the life of those around me. And all I care about are the people that I love. All I care about is Steph and the girls. And, you know, and then beyond that, the family. But do I know who I am? No, I think, if I'm honest, looking you right in the eye now, I'd say I'm still pretty confused. I mean, it's clearer because I've been very honest about it. So I know that about, but I've known that about myself for a bit of time. However, no, I don't think I do. I think I'm probably just as muddy as it was before. And everyone says, you know, you're going to live your best life. Mm. Don't know what that means. I thought I was.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a negative at all. I think it's actually very freeing to not know, because often I think when we think we know who we are, that is probably more to do with ego, or probably more to do with labels we've given ourselves or roles that we play. And if you dare to strip all of that away, you are left with, well, who am I? And I think that's probably where you get curious and then start working out, what do I really want? You know, what could really bring me joy in life, rather than just the things we think we should be doing. So I don't think that's a negative at all. And I also don't think it's a negative to not know what you're doing next. Because like you said, you know, there's that wonder of, well, what do I do next? How do I live my best life? How do you feel about free falling into that and not knowing?
Mm. Well, I mean, As I've pointed out, I am a guilt ninja. Mm. I mean, that is my absolute best emotion. Yeah. I am best at that than anything. And people have talked about, and I did a lot of research, and I read papers, I read all sorts of studies and things. And shame was a big part of the path that I knew I was going to take. I don't feel that at all. There's no shame. I'm proud of who I am. I'm happy with who I am. I'm not happy with the damage it causes. I'm not happy with the upset that it causes. And I am I'm not happy about the guilt, because I am in this weird minefield that every step I take, I could blow someone else up. And that is the weirdest feeling, you know, and I've never felt like that before. I've always been really careful with the girls when we took them to school. I never did anything embarrassing on the telly that would embarrass the girls. Until they were old enough. And until then, we could all have a laugh about it. Then suddenly you're doing this public thing that you can't do on your own, that you have to take your whole family with you, and you've got to then all find your levels, your the way through. And the girls are lucky, so lucky. They've got the best boyfriends. They're so sweet, so supportive. So I'm happy for them. Obviously, you know, I worry about Steph. I worry about what this does to all of us. And you know, that's an overriding factor, I think.
Yeah, I just guess the truth is always not more important, but it's just the truth has to surface for everyone's happiness, doesn't it? Not only for yours, which I think is, that's probably where your guilt's coming from, the fact that you think it's just about you revealing your truth. But I think for everybody's happiness, if we're all honest with ourselves and with others, I think eventually that does lead ultimately to happiness for everyone. I guess it's just, you know, where you're at during that process. And I just think that's actually the girls are really lucky that you've been that truthful, because you're inspiring them to do the same, that they will never have to live a life that isn't an honest life, which I think is really integral to well-being and happiness.
Well, we talk a lot. We all talk a lot, which is important. And, you know, Steph and I talk a lot. It's a peculiar thing to have to go through as a couple, and then as an individual. And people keep saying, you know, the truth sets you free. Well, I never felt like I was in any way not free. But you know, then you begin to think, well, maybe there is another door open, but I'm actually too scared to jump through it at the moment. That's what Charlie Mackesy. I love the fact that Charlie Mackesy did my illustration on the back of the book, and took the words. I mean, it was amazing that he actually took my words. But I'm wearing new clothes and they don't quite fit. But maybe I'll grow into them. And there is that feeling that's an aspect of it as well. Is that I had before we all got locked down. I had lunch with Michelle Visage.
And, incredible.
How about that?
Already I love this story.
How about that? And I said, and she said, how do you feel? Because she's one of those really compassionate, kind people. And I've known her, we've gone on off for telly and all that sort of stuff. And she was one of those people that messaged me and said, the most amazing people messaged me. And she said, I'm going to take you out for coffee. We've got to talk. I want to make sure you're okay. And that's what a lot of people have said. Are you okay? Are you sure you're okay? And we went out and I said, I feel like I've joined a club, but, you know, I don't know whether I've got the right credentials. I don't know, can I put a rainbow after stuff that I've said? And she said, of course you can. And I said, well, I don't know what I can and can't do. And she said, you're beating yourself up for no reason. You know, welcome to the club. And what's more, you have made a massive difference to people who also didn't realize that they perhaps could have membership to that club. And I was beginning to, you know, I understand that. I can begin to understand that, picking my way through. And then we got locked down. And that was the that was the beginning of all of those things. And thinking, okay, I begin to understand this. I'm beginning to find that little bit in my head through help. And I've had a lot of help. It is just a case of colouring in all the bits.
And when you say help, you're quite open in the book that you have seen a therapist and still do see a therapist.
I have seen two psychiatrists and a psychologist. And psychiatry is not for me. But is for a great many people. But the way that works, I didn't necessarily get very much out of that. I just remember, and it's actually a story that I tell. But your hour is up. I have stripped myself totally bare. I am weeping. My face is blotchy. I've got red eyes, and your time is up. And the next thing you know, you're out in the street. Mm. And I thought, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god. And Tony, who also features quite a lot in the book, is my incredibly ever loyal driver. He's up the road. He doesn't know where I am, doesn't know what I'm doing. So he can't see me with a blotchy face. So I run around the corner. I'm standing in a mews. And this guy comes up on a bike and stops and goes, hey, Phil, you got to see Kinky Boots, mate. I'm in it. It's a great show. Yeah, will do. No problem at all. And I thought, I don't know that this is for me. And because I was in such a mess.
Yeah.
But however, psychology is a whole different thing. And that's not let me sit and listen to everything and you give me, which I think psychiatry is you give me your answers. You tell me everything and then you tell me what you think about what you've told me. And I just wanted to just help me.
Yeah.
Whereas psychology is very much, and certainly with the lady that I talk to, is about building me up. It's about telling me that everything is going to be okay. It's about my emotions and moods. It's about spotting improvements. Do you realize that you've just said this, but when we spoke 6 weeks ago, you would never have said that? It's all of that. And I found that much more inclusive. It was almost as if my brain was actually allowed into the party, where it was, we were all there together type of thing. Mm. I feel a lot better about myself with psychology than I did with psychiatry, but as I said, that's just me.
Well, I've had a very similar experience, actually. I feel exactly the same, and I've seen, God, countless therapists and all sorts of things over the years. And what I've realised the most brilliant thing is there used to be, again, so much stigma around seeing a psychologist, a therapist, a healer, whoever, because that meant there was something wrong with you. And I now see it as the best gift ever. It's the most positive thing, whether you're in a good space or not, that you have someone completely trusted, that you have an open dialogue with, that inherently understands everything from, your mind and your story, and can help piece that together. And I just think it's a wonderful tool if it's available to you.
Well,
I'm a
big old cynic. I was a big old cynic. What can you tell me about myself that I don't already know? I know myself inside out. I know my darkest parts of my head, which, now there they are. I mean, it's out there. What can you possibly tell me about myself? And then the greatest shock to me was when she did and said something that I thought, oh, I never thought of that before. Oh my God, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And I have, they had this awful vision, and she jokes about this terrible vision I have of myself in the future, sort of absolutely alone, being eaten by my own dogs.
No, that's quite extreme.
She said, I mean, I haven't ever said that, but she's put it into those words. And because everything is scary.
Yeah.
At this stage, everything is frightening, but she's just put it all in the right place. And as I point out, and I'm at great pains to point out, if there is, you just said it then. There was a time when, you think, oh, I don't know whether this is, the people who went to see therapists or healers or psychiatrists or psychologists, there is something wrong. Mm. Now, no, hold on a second. You have to go. You have to talk to someone. Mm. You have to talk to someone. If there is something in your head that is tripping you up, you can't fix it on your own.
No.
You've got to talk to somebody. Mm. And that was the hardest thing for me, was to admit, actually, I need to say this out loud. It's not something that I can deal with myself.
Yeah,
you've got to seek help.
It's important to have someone also completely impartial, I think, where emotions aren't in any way affecting them, and you can have that clarity with a stranger, essentially, who you build up a rapport with and build up trust with.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
So let's talk about that last chapter, because from the moment I started reading that chapter, you could tell it was a complete roller coaster for you. It's a roller coaster for the reader. How did you get in a good headspace to be able to sit and truthfully write what you have in the book?
I sat for a whole morning. I knew it was coming. I knew what was, you know, that you're getting there, and you're going through the latter part of your life, and you're telling your stories, and all the stories your mates have said, you've got to put that in, that's the funniest thing. So putting all of that in, and in the distance, I could see it coming. Mm. And I knew I was going to have to get there, and then, you know, this morning moves from the South Bank to Television Centre, and I'm getting closer and closer and closer. And then on the morning that, you know, that I got there, I just opened the laptop, and it was a beautiful sunny day. And I just looked at the cursor blinking on and off and thought, I don't know how to do this. And in fact, the way I've written it is exactly how that morning was. Mm. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to even begin this. And then I went out for a walk, and then I had 3 cups of tea, and the cursor was still blinking and nothing was happening. And everything else had just fallen out of my head. And I just thought, you have to listen. What you write here can be edited. What you write here, you can go back and change. So just let it go. And that was what I did. I just thought, right, that's it. That's it. You know, what you're writing here is not, you're not saying it live on the telly. You are, this is not the version necessarily that you'll want to put out. As it happens, it pretty much is. Mm. There was very little change. But I just thought, right, just do it.
Yeah.
And I did.
And you explain beautifully about the turmoil that you were in because of this sort of double-headed pop problem that was going on at the time. So you not only had the confusion around your sexuality and wondering what to do next and who you should tell or who you should speak to or when that might be, you know, the truth told publicly, but also you had the press with their eye on you and making false accusations about you, false accusations about your relationship with Holly. And I think you've got so much dignity in the book how you talk about this, because you sort of say, you know, if you're in the public eye, it's to be expected that the press will at one point focus on you and go for you. And I had to sort of sit back and question it, because, you know, I've been in that position. I've had the press absolutely tear me apart to the point where I didn't know if I wanted to do the job anymore. And it definitely impacted me at a very vulnerable time anyway, when I was feeling extremely low, extremely lonely, and in a very, very dark place. And what I think is so fundamentally unhealthy is the fact that there's this expectation that people in the public eye should have this perfect life, stain-free, no problems, no confusion, no worry, no trauma. And that is essentially taking away the human element of someone, because we've all got stuff going on. We're all flawed. We all have problems going on. And I wonder how that impacted you mentally and how you found peace with it.
Well, I have, on the whole, had a really good run with the press. They've been occasionally they'll give you a bit of a battering, but, you know, it's generally deserved in some way or shape or form. We've done something wrong. All been hauled up, you know, been picked up, keeps our feet on the floor. You know, I'm fine with that. It's okay. I don't mind. But I think it was the fact that I couldn't understand why it was my turn. But even if I did understand why it was my turn, I didn't understand why it was so sustained. And it was sustained for months. And it was, you know, Philip and Holly in bitter feud. And in fact, you know, Holly knew. I told her. I was sobbing on her shoulders, you know, and we were picking our way through this. She was seeing me through the show. We were talking about it beforehand. And so it was such a weird juxtaposition, you know, with fact and fiction, that this was actually all written down. And people, what is extraordinary is the fact that people are perfectly, you watch us every morning on the telly, yet you are prepared to believe that we're in a bitter feud. Just look at us. Mm. It's not possible. But anyway, she was dealing with me and looking after me and her incredible, wise, gentle wisdom, which she has. And at the same time, we're allegedly in this bitter feud, which is fine. That's okay. That's the way the job goes. These things happen. However, and as I've said, you know, people could quite rightly say, grow a pair. You have a great garden. You have a nice job. You've got lovely friends. You've got a nice car. What's the matter with you? You get a bit of a battering. Take it on the chin, mate. And I would say, yes, That is true, apart from the fact this time it happened off the back of some other massive, great, swirling, tumultuous storm that was going on in my head. And the two of them together, that was when it got dangerous. That was a dangerous time. You know, taken in isolation, they're both very big things. Sexuality is a much bigger thing than you getting a hard time in the press.
But when you're in a vulnerable state, which you were and which I was at the time, many years ago, that is very dangerous. And we've seen how that can lead to the most utterly devastating outcomes. And I just think, well, what do I want to say? Fucking hell, amazing that you got through it. I mean, incredible that you got through it and that you were still courageous enough to sit on live TV and do such a raw interview and put your heart out there. I just, you know, impeccably done. And I really hope that, you know, gave you some mental peace, having that moment and being able to, you know, on your show, on your, on your watch, sit and explain yourself to everybody.
Well, it was, no aspect of that was funny, but it was the fact that nobody knew what I was going to do. And it is testament to the unbelievable friends that I've got who all knew what I was going to do. And each one of them I told at the right time, oh my God, that explains why you're so thin. That explains why you're so upset. Explains why you look so sad. Not one of my friends said, oh, that's funny. Yeah, we've always had our thoughts. No, I took everyone by surprise. And so when I did that on the telly, nobody knew it was going to happen. I write all about the moment that my thumb pressed the button to release the statement. And then I went upstairs with Holly and it was like the whole of our industry, and specifically we're talking about the press, just went, oh, shit, what is this? And I think a few of them, one of the journalists who'd given me a bit of a hard time, and it's everybody's job, you know, I don't hold any bitter grudges, you know, that's the way it is. We all do our job. I'd hope it just be fair.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know, okay, so that's what you do. Actually texted me. So she'd obviously had my number all the way through. Didn't text me to say, are you okay? Didn't text me to check whether anything might be true that she was writing or they were writing. But nevertheless, she texted me and said at the end of it, I know we've had a bit of a tricky time. I'd love to build some bridges. And what you've done today has set the cause forward 10 years.
Yeah.
And that made me feel better because that was coming directly from someone who'd actually given me quite a bit of a hard time. Mm. But I don't hold grudges like that. Life's too short. I've discovered life is too short. I'd love everyone to be kind, but, you know, we don't live in some sort of fairy tale and people aren't going to be kind. And not everyone is kind to me, but most people are. And that's all you can really ask for.
Absolutely. And, you know, you had a really dark time over New Year just gone with both of these things circulating in your head. And you talk a lot about in the book, these sort of loops that you run through in your head at nighttime and you can't sleep and it's lots of thought processes going round and round. First of all, what cognitively was going on for you when you were in that dark place?
Principally, and I describe those loops as being, you know, there's one gigantic loop, which is your sexuality. You know, you have now got to the point where this has tripped you up so badly. It's now hurting you, and the fact that that only you and Steph know is really hurting me mentally and beginning to cause me serious damage, and the newspaper stuff is all sort of secondary, but what was an issue with the newspaper stuff was that what I had every single day dealing with the sexuality in my head, every single day I had the safety of work. The work that I think, you know, if you read through the book, you can see how much I love my job.
Completely.
Right from the word go. I just am so passionate about what I do and the people I meet and the shows that I do and the smell of a studio and all of that. So, so passionately love it. And that was what I was holding on to. The anchor was walking with Holly every morning from the makeup room downstairs up to the studio, put it all on the back burner, put the or your whole world, your life on the back burner, and do your job and go live to on the telly and listen to the talk back in your ear and, you know, all of the things that we do. And then that rug got pulled out from underneath my feet. My one safety net, the one safe place that I had, other than obviously hugging Steph. But at work, it was a safe place and it just was dragged off. And that was tough. Because you have nowhere to go. You know, you suddenly, if you haven't got that, then, you know, where does your head settle? What do you cling to? What do you hold on to? And everything else was like quicksand. Everything else was shifting. And the loops were so massive in my head that I thought, I've got nothing to hold on to here. Yeah. And that's when I thought, I am in a very dark place. I'm in a very dangerous place here now. And Steph was incredible. And so, you know, calming, knowing the turmoil that, you know, that was going on. She was so calming. Mm. So, you know, I think that was what was going through my head at Christmas and New Year.
I mean, I've been there. I totally know those feelings, and it's horrific. And there'll be many people listening to this who will have absolutely been there, and it's a pit of despair, and you feel like you might not come out of it. What were your first positive steps to make change, to shift, to get into a new space and to not feel that you were in that sort of heaviness?
Deciding the decision I had to make.
Yeah.
That was the biggest one. This is what you have to do. And that's the loop. You know, the loop is, one of them, is you have to come out. You have to come out. It's the only thing that can save you. You have to come out. You can't come out. You can't come out. What are you going to do to the family? What will you do to your wife? How can you possibly come out? You have to come out. You can't come out. You have to. You can't. All night, round and round and round and round, looking at every conceivable part of this loop, playing it round and round. How can I make it work? How can I make it work? Yes, I'm sure you can make it work. If you talk about it, you can make it work. You can't make this work. No one can make this work. You can't be married for 27 years and make this work. You can't do this without hurting everybody. But what about me? If I don't do this, then I all I hurt is myself. Maybe really seriously. And so, you know, that's what goes around and round and round and round and round. Then you get up in the morning and it's going around whilst you're having a shave, and you get in the shower and it's still going around in your head when you're having a shower. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? I get in the car, I write a script. I'm writing the notes for my interviews. And there's the other part of my head, you know, whilst you're trying to concentrate on this, is saying, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? And I just thought, I have to, if only to shut you up.
Yeah.
If only to shut that up, I have to do this. And that was the beginning of it. When, you know, we talked it through at home. And this is what I'm going to do. Okay. You know, it's not easy. It's not going to be easy for, you know, for any of us. But it made a couple of the loops quieter. And it's not now as bleak as it was. I mean, it was bleak, but it's not now. I mean, I have a great relationship with everybody. I talk to Steph a lot, you know, see each other a lot. So, you know, it's, I think it's, yeah, it's a case of, well, I think I mean, I've said, you know, you have to talk these things out, and you have to hope that you know, you've got to know that the people who love you for a reason. They love you because you're worth loving. That's why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I guess also that nothing is linear. You know, we sometimes talk about mental health like, I felt like this and then I felt great. And it's this sort of ascent to just finding that balance and that perfection. I think it's actually really important, like you discussed in the last chapter, that it's a wiggly line. There's moments where you do feel lighter and better, and there are moments where you're still figuring it out. And you mentioned in the book that your mental health is still work in progress, very much the same here. Where would you say you're at with that today?
It's a lovely sunny day, you know. I'm sitting with one of my mates. Admittedly, the trains are a little noisy. However, that's the only negative. I'm okay. I'm suddenly seem to be a lot more interesting than I ever used to be. I pedaled here on my bike with a pap But Pat was behind me taking
all
pictures.
All three of us cycled here, by the way.
Is that
today?
Right?
Yeah, that's good to know.
Yeah. Mm. The Paps aren't bothering me. And then suddenly they are. Other than that, but then I thought, how do you feel about that? And you think, okay, it's all right. You feel okay. You're okay. It's okay. So how am I? I would say I am more okay than I've been for a while. Work is my, wonderful sanctuary. Holly throughout lockdown, I mean, it was the most bizarre thing to do a live TV show during that. And have, you know, the nation sitting there going, oh, thank God you're still here, because, you know, if it wasn't for you, we'd all go mad. And at least we've got something normal happening. But to do that show, and because Good Morning Britain, I mean, this is sort of technical stuff, you'll cut this out, but Lorraine is normally in her own studio. Lorraine was sitting on the Good Morning Britain set, and they're next door to us. They're behind our view, so we share a studio. So that meant that that studio, it didn't become ours until they went off air. So we had 4 minutes of a commercial break for that studio to become ours. So our lights didn't go on until they came off air, and we had 4 minutes. The cameras came on, the lights came on. We're sitting in the dark about to do a live show. And there were times when we all looked at each other and just went, what the fuck are we doing here? What is going on? And then, you know, then you'd laugh and then you set off on a show that you weren't entirely sure what we were going to do, but, and it all came together. That was amazing. That time was amazing. And, I got my rug back. You know, I got my feet back under the desk. I felt okay. I'm solid in my job. We're doing a good thing. And that helped me enormously, massively. And so that made me more than okay. The rest of it, you just pick through on a daily basis.
That's it. It's day to day, isn't it? It's moment to moment. None of us really know what's going to happen anyway, as this year has jolly well proved none of us have a clue what's going on. And again, a remarkable thing that I felt reading the book was that all through this mental torment, you managed to get to work every day, bar one day, to do what you set out to do. I definitely can't say the same, but you didn't allow that mental torment to cross over. You could almost compartmentalize in your head, this is now work time, and then at home, privately, you would be in turmoil. That must have been a draining situation to keep having to sort of switch from, this is me at work, and then at home, this is something else going on.
Well, it was draining in the fact that no one other than Holly knew.
Yeah.
So that was draining because everyone, all the people that I work with, and we have got our glam squad who, you know, lovely Susie does my makeup and David who does my clothes, editor Martin Frizzell, who is, you know, the most amazing and lovely guy. All our whole team just thought I was really ill. I mean, seriously ill. I was losing weight. I was thin. I was just staring into the mirror. And I mentioned Gino DeCampo. I'm in a commercial break. I had no idea that I'd caught his attention until he tapped me on the shoulder and said, "What is it? What's the matter?" I said, "What?" He said, "You've been standing in the middle of the studio, staring at your feet for 3.5 minutes. What's the matter? What are you thinking? What is in your head right now?" So I said, no, I'm fine. And he went back behind his kitchen and did the universal sign for give me a call, talk to me, which I didn't. You got all of that going on. And I think it was the worry of other people that was a bit unsettling. I knew they were all worried and I couldn't not do it. I couldn't be jokey and jovial. I wasn't jokey and jovial in the makeup chair. I was just a bit quiet. Phil's a bit quiet. He's looking a bit thin. And so when it came to telling the people that I had to tell, they all said to a man and a woman, "Oh, thank God, I thought you were dying."
Yeah.
And Martin Frizzell said, "Is that all?" So I said, "Yes, that's it." He said, "Thank fuck, I thought you were dying." No, no, that's all. "Oh, thank God." And there was a lot of that. "Is that all?" You know, then people thought that I was, you know, on my way out.
You talking to your mum made me actually really chuckle.
Yes. My mum. Oh my God. It's only your mother can come out with something that is totally left field. I have these floaters in my, they drive me mad. And I'm, I think I'm about to, maybe in the October half term, finally, I've managed, we might have managed to find a way to get rid of them. But these floaters which just drift, my world, I just constantly look like I'm looking through a dirty bathroom window.
Oh God.
That's my view on the world. And so they're annoying, but that's it. Nothing more than annoying. And I had to go and tell my mum. And at Christmas, she had, or before Christmas, she pulled me over to one side and she said, what's the matter? I said, no, nothing, I'm fine. She said, don't lie to me. I know there's something wrong. She, I can see you're skinnier than you ever are. You know, you've got a drawn look on your face. You look worried. You look sad. What's the matter? No, nothing, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. And so when the time came to tell her, I thought, well, I can't drive down to Cornwall because I don't know that I can concentrate enough. So I asked Tony to drive me. He never says a word, obviously. Didn't ask why I was going to Cornwall for no good reason. Driving down and then driving back on the same day. We stopped off and we got some fish and chips and I took them to my mum's and she knew I was coming. And I sat down and we're looking at Fistral Beach out of her window, and that's the beach where I'd done the Radio 1 Roadshow and so much of my life was on that beach. And here I am sitting with my mum and about to tell her what I'm about to tell her. And I said, Mum, I've got something really big to say. And she said, okay, that's all right, that's okay. Doesn't matter, everything's fine, what's the matter? I said, I'm gay. And she said, oh, thank God, I thought you were going blind. Blind? Blind? Why the hell did you think I was going blind? She said, well, your floater thing. I said, no.
But that must have just been like a big sigh of relief. Thank you, Mum, for coming out with that absolute winner.
Yeah, and she's proved to be the most thoroughly modern 84-year-old. How are you doing? How's this? You know, what are you thinking? Let's talk about it. Everything's going to be okay. You know, so people surprise you the most. And I've said that. I say that in there. You know, if you have something like this that is burrowing into your brain, then you never know. And I'm fully aware that there are some families that do that. Their reaction is not like this. And that is a great sadness to me, is that not everyone's going to get the reaction that I got. But I was lucky. And even if it's one member of your family you can talk to that you can trust, if there's someone there you can bounce off someone, then you know, it doesn't necessarily always have to be a trained therapist that you talk to. If you just talk to your best mate, talk to someone you can trust. But I was lucky that I could talk to my family and I could talk to my mum.
Yeah.
You know, what a thing.
It's so often the case that you build something up in your head and, you know, like you've discussed with the loops that are just constantly going, and many people have experienced this. And you think of the worst possible outcome of what people are going to say and think. And it's so rarely the case. And actually, often the things that you're the most terrified to say are the most connective. People feel, you know, especially in the position you're in, having such a huge public following, you've now inspired, you know, thousands of people and connected them, and you're more connected to them. So often we think these are the things that alienate us. Like for me, it was depression, panic attacks down the line. This makes me, you know, different to everybody else, whatever. No, this has made me more connected to people in a deeper way, I think. Have you experienced that?
Well, yeah. I was terrified of after the event and Holly's amazing interview on the sofa. And then I went back home and I sat with the girls and Steph that evening, and we're all, you know, sort of thinking, right, okay, my phone was alight with people going, oh my God, you're amazing. And like friends who had no clue. Oh my God, this is incredible. You know, what you've done today is, you know, you're a legend and all of those sort of things. And so, you know, picking up those sort of pieces and being that evening with the girls and Steph was lovely, but I knew that I had to sort of go out and be this person now. You know, I'm still me. And there's actually no difference whatsoever to the me that walks outside and goes into a shop. But I was still scared when I did. And I went into a card shop and I bought a card. And the lady behind the counter said, and this is like a day after, she said, are you okay? And I'd never seen this lady before in my life. And I said, yeah. It's going to make me cry. She said, are you okay? So I said, yeah, I am okay. And she said, good, that's the most important thing. Anyway, I walked to the door and a very elegant elderly lady who was incredibly smart and very sharp grabbed my shoulder, and I thought, oh shit, here we go. This is the one thing I was terrified about is going to happen in the doorway of a card shop. And I thought, she's going to give me a hard time. I'm not going to be what she expected me to be. And she just, this very elegant, sharp lady said, ah, it's you. So I said, yes. Well done. Well done. I said, oh, thank you. And she said, I can't tell you the good you've done. I can't tell you the amount of lives you have saved. Mm. You are a remarkable man, and thank you. I said, thank you. And I was in tears. And she walked off down the street. And that's actually been pretty much what it was. Mm. I walked through Borough Market, and people were just hugging me and saying, oh my God, you're amazing. You're amazing. What an incredible thing to do. You know, you're so brave. You're so brave. And I was just getting random hugs from people. Mm. I think that's what I miss the most, you know, in the world that we now live in.
I know.
Is because I had this window, this sort of three or four weeks of getting used to it with kindness, and people were kind. And then, you know, then we all went in, you know. Mm. But I had a few weeks of kindness, and then, but people are still lovely now. People are, you know, as I said, social media can be a brutal place, yeah, as we well know. And that is brutal. But on the whole, people are really very kind. Mm. And the reaction from that lady and the lady who sold me the card has been, you know, thankfully pretty much what I've had.
People love celebrating the truth, don't they? We all carry baggage around with us, and secrets, and things that we feel we can't say aloud. And it's a bit of a snowball effect, isn't it? One person, or a domino effect rather, one person, you know, says something very meaningful and truthful, and other people feel compelled to do the same. It's a really beautiful thing. It's so interesting looking at how you've led your life. So to me, you are what I would call like a super manifester. You know, you put that thing out there and it happens, you know, from like you saying, when you're on Fistral Beach and you're at the Radio 1 Roadshow and you're the guy up on the stage saying, hey, this is me, and I'm kicking things off here on my home turf. And, you know, it's a really unusual and amazing quality to have. And you've done that consistently, you know, your whole career. Every dream that you've had, you've worked hard, but you've really focused on that, and you've made it happen. And I guess, I don't know, I'm just sat here thinking now, maybe some of that sort of uncertainty you have now is because you don't know what that next bit might look like. And before, you've perhaps been so sure as to what it might look like.
Yeah, I think you've put your finger directly on it, there's always been, I've always, you know, sort of, as far as career is concerned, there's been a single path, you know, and as far as fatherhood and being a husband, there was always a, you know, a very clear path, until suddenly there wasn't. Not suddenly, gradually there wasn't a clear path, and the path got a little bit confused, and I didn't quite understand what the path was, and then the path suddenly wasn't there at all anymore. And so, you know, then you're walking through a Charlie Mackesy wilderness. You're walking through the storm, but you've got the people with you. You can hold on to. And then off now, suddenly, you know, maybe I can see the beginnings of a path in front of me that, you know, that I can map out what's going to happen. I don't know. I don't know what my future is. I don't know what it's going to be. I know that I know that we all love each other. I know that we're all incredibly close. I know that I don't want to hurt anyone any more than I've already hurt them. But I also know that, you know, we are us four, but, you know, the same but different. And we're finding our way. I am still very much finding my way as to what's expected of me, what I should do. I'm not rushing out and, you know, yeah, here we go, you know, suddenly sort of singing some great gay anthem. I'm not doing that. You know, it's all happening slowly.
Yeah. And that's the right thing to do, day by day, day by day. Philip, God, I thank you so much for being part of this conversation, and thank you for writing your beautiful book that, as I said, I couldn't put it down, but also it's going to change a lot of lives. It's going to help so many people.
I hope so. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Philip. Thank you so much. I loved, loved, loved that conversation, and I feel really honoured to have been part of it. It's really, I just appreciate Philip being so honest. It was lovely. His book, Life's What You Make It, is available now, and I read it in 2 days. You can't put this book down. It's insane. If this is your first dip into Happy Place, welcome along. I love you already. Hello. Please do take a look through our other episodes. I'd recommend scrolling all the way down to Dawn French right at the start, which we recorded in her house in Cornwall. It was so beautiful. You can subscribe for free to hear new shows every Monday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or on your Google or Amazon device. Thanks again, Philip, to the producer, Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, and to you lot. I love you. I really do. And I'll see you next week.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.